Well, welcome to our worship service this morning here at KBC. It's wonderful to have you with us here in the real midst of the summer, as we have found out here in Ottawa. This is now our fourth month, almost to the day, since COVID began, and we are enjoying our time and sharing with you wherever you're viewing this from. Some of you will be at the cottage, some will be at home. We hope and trust that you're having a refreshing weekend. A couple weeks ago, I was contemplating getting the haircut. Up to this point, Meredith, my wife, has been cutting my hair. She's been doing a fantastic job. We used to pray about it before she would attempt to do it, but despite that, she did a wonderful job. So this week, I went to see my normal hairdresser, and she thought that she'd done a wonderful job. But as you can see, she took pains to make sure that I don't go back until about October. Hairdresser did mention, however, that she's seen some very interesting things come into her salon, that's for sure. Also, you know, besides the haircut issue and things that we've been picking up during COVID, I have, as I've mentioned before, picked up a bit of gardening because I haven't been traveling as much as usual. So this spring I had an opportunity to recreate all of our gardens. And over the years that means the care and feeding of about 600 square feet of space. They've just grown and grown and grown. I can't tell you what everything is by name, how fast they grow. I do know that. I know what a weed is, sort of, and what is not. So I work basically to get the right look in the garden. But this year, I added some nutrients like crazy. I went a little overboard. I got all the sheep stuff, which I won't go into any detail, some peat moss, some fresh black topsoil, and appropriate mulch, turned everything over in the gardens, gutted one garden that was ripe with weeds, transplanted a few things to get the overall look just right, created a new rock garden because the grass had wasn't producing at all, tended to the many hanging baskets that we have around the perimeter, and watered like mad ever since early May. Things have absolutely exploded. We have a regular Bouchard Gardens in our yard. Those of you who grew up in the West or know Victoria know what that means. Fine-tuning, just to get things right. Sun, earth, water, shade, spacing, pruning. But there's one plant which sits beside the spitting frog in the little pond that we have that's very particular. And last week it was languishing terribly, bent over, withered, and wilted. No problem with the water, but obviously too much water for this little one. So I modulated the water into a sprinkling. Day by day, it reflowered, perked up, and with just the right light and the water and the atmosphere, it came alive almost overnight. Wilted, on the way to death. The right conditions saw its full potential. Actually, the flower came into its full glory just a couple of days ago. We know biblically that that word glory means weighty or evidential, that it's what you can see. It's actually biblically God's presence in creation, God's presence and his glory present in creation, and God's glory and presence actually in us and working through us. Plants are in their glory. God shows up in his glory. And that's really what this passage today is all about in John's gospel. Light. He's talking about light. Something that shows up and illuminates and glorifies everything around it. John, who wrote this particular gospel, goes to great lengths to speak about Jesus as the fresh expression of God the Father. The one true God who came in human form, that was scandal enough. But that person of Jesus shed light on the character and person of God. This is God in the flesh. So as John begins to flesh this out in his gospel, he goes to great lengths to use this image of light all through. From the very first verses of John chapter 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through Him all things were made. Without Him nothing was made that has been made. In Him was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. Jesus came to illuminate the dark places. John chapter 1, verse later, a man named John came along, a witness concerning that very light that was coming, so that through him all might believe. He himself wasn't the light. He came to witness to the light, the true light, that is light to every person was coming into the world. That would be the light of Jesus himself, pointing to a greater reality. That very famous passage that we have seen and memorized, John 3:16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life." This is the verdict. Light has come into the world. But men love darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that their deeds will be exposed. But whoever lives by the truth comes into the light. Here John keeps repeating this theme over and over. John chapter 8 is probably the quintessential passage. When Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." And in the passage that we're reading today, John chapter 9, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents?" Jesus heals the man and then says, "While I am in the world, I am the light of the world." He's comparing living in spiritual blindness with someone who has been blind from birth. Spiritual blindness, coming into the light, and his own mission, which was to uncover the darkness and bring light. And lastly, as John begins to express this even more in the 12th chapter, Jesus cried out, "When a person believes in me, he does not believe in me only, but the one who sent me. When he looks at me, he sees the one who sent me. I have come into the world as a light, so that no one who believes in me should stay in darkness." Here's a question that would come to any of us. Is there anything unique about Christianity? Well, John chapter 8 and verse 12, "I am the light of the world, the light of life," Jesus says. Who says things like that? That is an astounding phrase. Could we say that about ourselves? I don't think so. We'd be categorically excoriated for saying something like that. It's brash. It's out of the ordinary. It's controversial. Jesus is in essence saying, if you do not find me, you will never find out what life is all about. It is about me. This is a relentless theme in John's gospel. So, what's life about? Well, certainly about financial issues and money and surviving. We're very concerned right now about economic survival and economic recovery. We talk about that all the time. It's our number one issue that we're trying to break out of as we get out of this particular phase of the COVID thing. Surviving the present threats of the day, all the challenges before us. But one of the biggest ones is loneliness. It's a pervasive enemy right now. There's an epidemic of proportionality. Are we truly alone when we're alone? That very stunning reality of exposing our need for other people. Do we have the resources actually to handle this particular moment? One of the realities we're experiencing also is a collective sense of mortality. We shrug it off most of the time, and life is structured to put it off and out of our minds and actually domesticate it, but it sits in our faces now and must be dealt with, our mortality. How are we to face the end? Is there any light at all? Who are we facing at the end? Do we really need Jesus in this moment? Is that an appropriate discussion? Is what I'm doing equipping me to face the worst that could come? Can we see what is ahead? Can Jesus deliver the goods? Those are really valid questions. So John records this remarkable story. A man with congenital blindness. He had never seen the light of day. Anything that is beautiful is a foreign concept. He is dependent on everyone for his future and his past. Education would be a loss to him. He cannot survive on his own. He knows he must rely on his wits, which you'll see in a moment, and a few people around him who he can trust. All of this is crucial as the story plays out. Jesus walks by. He encounters this man, and life is never the same again. And that's actually a theme that Jesus repeats as he meets people on the way constantly, and is actually true of us as well. It's not possible to meet Jesus and stay where we were before. There are six scenes in the story as told by John. First of all, it's a street in Jerusalem near the temple in the Jewish quarter where the healing takes place for seven verses. Near the man's home, the neighbors are questioning his healing. That's the next four verses. Near the Sanhedrin, or the parliament of the ruling body of the Jewish elders, where the Pharisees question his healing. Back again in the same courtroom, but the Pharisees are now interviewing the man's parents. Then another scene, the same courtroom, Pharisees again questioning the man himself who was healed. And then the last scene, another street near the courtroom where Jesus is speaking again to the religious leaders and bringing the whole discussion to a close. For John, what does it look like for someone to come to Jesus and believe in him and his kingdom? What happens when God shows up? Well, we know that there's many stories in John about people meeting Jesus. The story of Nicodemus, the Pharisee who comes to Jesus at night. The Samaritan woman who comes with a sordid history and believes. The official with the sick son who meets Jesus in that incredible scene. And here is yet another encounter. So first of all, we have the healing. It's a man who's born blind, as we've said. Not someone who'd lost his sight, but someone who had congenital blindness, blind from birth. The accusation against him is he was blind because of his sin. And that's a curiosity. It was a common held belief that one who was suffering was probably suffering because of a sin that they had committed. That he had done something wrong to cause this, or maybe his parents had done something wrong. And the belief was that one could even sin in the birth womb of the mother. That was all suffering would be as a result of sin. Jesus doesn't buy this. Even though we believe this sometimes today, it's a wrong view of God. Jesus doesn't buy it at all. God makes the rain to fall on the just and the unjust, Jesus says. Neither this man nor his parents sinned, said Jesus, but this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. As long as it's day, we must do the work of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world. And he links here the compassion and heart of God with his personal mission and the spiritual blindness and now the light that's been received by this man who's had his sight restored. John points to this as a sign. Something incredible has happened here. God has shown up. This is the sign of the coming Messiah, Isaiah says. The eyes of the blind will be opened. Jesus is pointing to his mission, his messiahship, and people are going to miss it. So then we have this amazing record of the interrogation that this man has to go through who has been healed. First of all, the neighbors question whether it's the same man. This cannot happen. This man, is he the same man who was healed that we knew for all these years? And the man who was healed responds this way, I am the man. He stands in front of them, I am the man. Well, how is it that your eyes were open, they demanded. The man they called Jesus made some mud and put it on my eyes. He told me to go to Siloam and wash, so I went and washed, and then I could see. Well, where is this man, they asked. I don't know, he said, and he didn't know. He doesn't care, actually. He's healed. And finds it really anticlimactic that people would actually question his healing and the dramatic release into his sightful state. Then the Pharisees get in on the action, on their turf. They questioned the healing based on the fact that it was done on the Sabbath and work was forbidden on the Sabbath. So this man could not have been from God, and this could not have taken place because it would actually happen on the Sabbath. But they are divided, for the man who stood before them was healed regardless, and they began to fight amongst themselves. Finally, they turned to the blind man and said, "What have you to say about this man? It was your eyes he opened." The man replied, "Oh, he's a prophet at least." Then they bring the parents in. Here it gets a little devious, threatening the parents that if they claim he was healed, they would be thrown out of the synagogue. It's a very troubling consequence for that family. But the parents are cagey. They know the score. They admit it, he's their son and was born blind, but they say, "Ask him. Don't ask us. Ask him. He's of age. He can tell you. He's standing right here." They actually throw him under the bus. Then they bring the man in again. A second time they summon the man who had been born blind. "Give glory to God. We know this man is a sinner." Well, the man says, "Whether he's a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I do know, I was blind. Now I see." And then he asked him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? I've told you already. How did you miss this? Why don't you listen? Do you want to hear it again?" And then in the most sarcastic statement in the whole New Testament, the man looks at the Pharisees and says, "Do you want to become his disciples too?" Laced with sarcasm. People must have been chuckling on the sidelines. That one hurt. That man is a smart man. But this must have hurt him deeply that no one would believe. He knows the surroundings. The man who was healed knew what he was doing. He knows the truth when he hears it. He's had to function that way all his life. He's had to live in a world where his hearing was most important. He had to follow and trust his instincts. He knows the truth because no matter the reason, he now sees. He trusts who has healed him. There's no guile in this. There's no suspicion. There's no hubris. He trusts Jesus and his motives. He's learned to do that with the people around him. And when Jesus points to God and that this is the sign he believes, he knows with integrity that Jesus is speaking the truth. Then finally, the Pharisees hurled insults at him. "You are this fellow's disciple. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this fellow, we don't know where he comes from." "Well, it's remarkable," the man says. "You don't know where he comes from, but he opened my eyes and healed me. We know that God doesn't listen to sinners. He listens to the godly man who does his will. Nobody has ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. It's never happened. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." More sarcasm. And then they threw him out. They threw him out. The leaders had no intention of following the evidence or believing. There's a couple of things which really stand out here. It's not ignorance that stops people believing. It's an unwillingness to believe. We can see what's right and still not follow. If only people could see the facts, but they simply will not, even though the facts are there for them to analyze. Jesus was altogether too upsetting. Not everyone will be open to what Jesus has to say. It's much, much too costly. And secondly, when people hate the message, they'll sometimes take it out on the messenger. They will find a way to blame. They take it out on the man who was healed in this case, but they won't take responsibility themselves. They will construct another whole scaffold to handle their lives. The man gets impertinent and they throw him out. We may be unloved because we bring the truth to bear, and we may be ignored because we believe in certain truths about who God is. It's very hard to admit that we need something in our life. I certainly understand that. God's word always brings division. Jesus promised that that would be the same. We're never left to be the same. Sometimes we have to bow the knee. If we reject it, our hearts will begin to harden. Why does John go here? Well, John writes that we might come to believe. It is his number one purpose. These stories and these things that he recounts of the true life of Jesus, he wants people to come to believe. He wants them to see the light. And there are signs to that. And if there are signs to lead people to belief, there's also those things that will show up that will reject the truth. It's not a matter of intellect. It's a matter of the will. Aldous Huxley, a very famous atheist, said, "I believe just what I wanted to believe, no more and no less. I wanted to believe that there was meaninglessness. So I went and I found it." Well, spiritual blindness is the person who has moved God off center stage. And the person who has moved back onto center stage is ourselves. I now play the role of God. It's the role of the spiritually blind, ignoring the signs, being spiritually alone when we're truly alone in the dark. Those moments when even though we are incredibly busy doing life, we wonder where it's leading. When the full weight of things that may have hurt us come to bear and we have no place to really process it or trust those who could help carry it for us. If we're unhappy, we can simply change the channel. If we're having trouble in our marriage, we can walk out. If there's anger and forgiveness, we can ignore it and cook it deep inside. Is there an intervention? Can we move out of this condition? Have we actually seen someone change? Jesus said, "I will come to the congenitally spiritually blind in the spirit world, and I will say, go and wash and see." COVID's done some very interesting things to my own recounting of the past. I've had some time on my hands, and sometimes the past comes rushing in. When I read this passage, I asked the question, has this happened to me? Just because I think you have to answer that question when you read this particular passage in John chapter 9. In searching for the future, is there anything in my past that can help and help understand and clarify this? When we go back to our place of birth, how do we feel? I've done that. I've walked the streets of my youth in Winnipeg. It brings back more memories than just the people. It's the spaces, it's the places, it's the experiences. It brings back who we were in those moments, brings back how far we've come or not come. It traces our movements and how we were guided in the most difficult of times to places and people that eternally should be thanked. The death of my best friend at the age of 18 and being immediately thrust back into my summer job after the funeral in southern BC, deep in the bush, with 30 out-of-control men hopped up on drugs every night or falling off their chairs because of drunkenness. I woke up one morning in that mining camp, that place of geological survey. Woke up one morning on my day off and having started my laundry in the laundromat, wandered up to the adjacent Chinese cemetery and read a book that had been tucked in my backpack for a month. I met Christ as clear as day when I read chapter 3. And here's the book. It sits on my desk. It's a constant reminder of God meeting me. A place to stand. A practical guide to Christian faith as a solid point from which to operate in contemporary life. And this book is as real today and as valid today as it was when it was written in the 1960s. When we see what's happened to someone, changed for good, do we see someone touched by the living God? The Pharisee says that they won't believe. No matter what they see, they will not change their minds. They'll fight to the death for the right to believe what we want or what we desire or what our heritage brings to us at that point. Evidence doesn't mean much at that point because one has already predetermined the result. We have to simply say that we are content to be stone blind. There is something out there beyond us. Jesus says, "I do not want you to be in the dark." Jesus cried out, "When someone believes in me, he does not believe in me only, but in the one who sent me. When he looks at me, he sees the one who sent me. I have come into the world as a light, so that no one who believes in me should stay in the darkness. Where is the daily joy that we can relish, where Jesus has front and center called us to be and walk with him? Have we really looked at Jesus closely? That cynical statement, do you want to become his disciples too? If we take the cynicism out of it, we can rephrase that. Do you want to become his disciple too? I trust that you take that seriously and you take it with the welcome and warmth and the compassion that I could offer it to you as a friend. For Jesus is alive and well and desires to touch us. May God bless you richly. Amen.